The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond. The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Keep tabs on screen time with the new Sky Broadband Buddy app.
Almost 5 years ago, my next guest's life changed drastically simply by answering a knock at his door. Andreas Christophorus joins us now to share his story. Andreas, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's nice to talk to you. If you wouldn't mind bringing us back to December 2014, I presume a day like any other, maybe give us a run through what sort of a day it was for you.
So yeah, December 2014, just started off just as another day. I was, at a time, very motivated businessman working at home that day. We're in the process of launching a new company, and it'd see me in my office 7 days a week, 16 hours a day, slogging it out. Mm. I still live in the same house. I live on a 1980s red brick cul-de-sac. Lovely street, nice road. Being on a cul-de-sac, you get to know the cars, you get to know the people that should be there. You just have a feeling and a knowledge of the road. I sat working in my office. My office looks out onto the road. And I noticed a red Peugeot Partner van drive down the road. And it caught my attention because it's exactly the same make, model and colour as a van which I own and use for work purposes. Mm. Quickly realised it wasn't my van and carried on about my business. Living in Cornwall, we are limited in what we can buy on the high street, so we end up buying a lot of stuff online. It's common to have couriers come to our house, you know, possibly a dozen times a week. You know, that people come and go very frequently. You don't think anything of it, really. Mm. About 5 minutes after seeing this red van, I had a knock at my door, went and opened it, as I would to any normal person. You know, we live in a nice area, and you don't think to check through a peephole. You don't think to check identity before you open the door. You just open the door. And as I opened the door, I instantly received about a pint of concentrated sulfuric acid to the face, whilst my attacker said, "This is for you, mate." I knew instantly it was acid. I'd spent a lot of my life working in the hospitality industry, working around swimming pools and so on, where obviously corrosive substances are used heavily. My T-shirt disintegrated from top to bottom, from my neckline down to the waist. It was just hanging off me like a waistcoat. And I think that was the determining factor of me knowing it was acid. My attacker, he was stood about two steps down from my front doorstep. So he threw the acid in an upward motion, covered my face, down my torso, obviously on my arms, especially where the T-shirt, which had turned into this waistcoat garment, was hanging on my arms. There's a lot of acid around there. Mm. But also there, because he threw it in an upward motion, the acid went up, it hit the ceiling above me and then rained back down on me. So I then had acid drips all down my back. I was living at home. My wife and my eldest son, my only son at the time, Theo, who was 80 months old at the time, and he, thankfully, had been up with a fever throughout the night. So he was in his cot. It's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm. My wife was in bed because she'd been up with my son throughout the night. And that's the first saving grace. They were kept out of harm's way. I yelled as loud as I could upstairs to my wife, called 999, someone's just thrown acid in my face. She, obviously, it's not something you expect to hear when you're being woken up abruptly. You know, it took a couple of attempts to get it through to her what had happened. Mm. And I ran through the house to my kitchen and started dousing myself with as much water as I could, not knowing categorically that was the correct thing to do, but logically it made sense. And if I'd known what I know now, I would have got upstairs and got in the shower and stayed there until the ambulance arrived. When the ambulance did arrive, I managed to get in. Paramedics got me in the ambulance. I managed to reel off as much of my medical information as I could to them, or what was needed anyway. And the police arrived, and I gave them as much information as I could about this red van that I deemed to be a suspicious vehicle.
And were you, Andreas, if I may ask you, were you in considerable pain, or were you in so much shock it was hard to register the pain?
It's a bit of both, if I do say so. I've been asked so many times to put it into words, explain the pain, but it's inexplicable. We can't. It's like nothing I've ever felt before. It's, you know, the closest way to describing it is it's as if someone's thrown petrol over you and then chucked a match. Mm. You know, you're on fire, but there's no flames. My face and my eyes were burning so badly. I could still see, but my face was swelling up. There was no doubt about it. I could feel, I kept touching it, and it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But every time I touched it, it just felt like dead meat. It didn't feel alive. It didn't feel like mine. It's the worst pain I've ever felt, and I'm sure it's probably the worst pain I'll ever feel.
The police had information on the attacker, and he was arrested, David Phillips. He lived 300 miles away from your house, a painter and decorator, as it happens. But their initial suspicions, Andreas, really focused on you in the middle of all that had happened to you. They were looking at you, and maybe tell us a little bit about that, about how it all proceeded from here.
So, yes, David Phillips was arrested before I woke up from a coma. The information that I gave about this red van was correct, and the police managed to trace it back to Phillips and Hastings. Mm. From day one, the police were very good to me. They said two things. We are going to get your attacker, and we're going to get the evidence why. And secondly, they said they strongly believed it wasn't mistaken identity. They were adamant I'd done something to warrant the attack. And that in itself was challenging, very challenging, because the police are there thinking you've done something to warrant this attack. So they dissect your life in every single way possible to try and find a reason why. And it started off when I was in an ICU, and I have very little memory of this happening, but they have a protocol where if they think you're going to die, they come in and get as much information out of you as possible. And I remember two police officers wheeling in this very archaic-looking bit of recording equipment. That's mostly what I remember, to be honest, with this ridiculous bit of recording equipment that came in that's bigger than a suitcase. But then from then on, it's, you know, our house got taken. We weren't allowed in our house. The cars got taken. Sat-navs, phones, iPads, computers, laptops, email accounts, Facebook accounts, eBay accounts. Any digital account you had was gone. You know, everything you owned, gone. Everything was then under the powers of the police. You know, and I'm everything from personal to business. They all our company files. We gave them access to our solicitors. We, you know, they had everything, and they were adamant I'd done something to warrant this attack, but they couldn't find a reason why. And it took some time for them to come round to the fact that, okay, maybe this was mistaken identity.
And in the middle of all of this, you were trying to come to terms with your new physical reality, and which must have affected every aspect of your life. I mean, whatever about the physicality of it, I presume sleep was... It wasn't part and parcel of your night.
Sleep was torturous. So my injuries, the big difference with acid attacks, two main injuries to focus on: burns and scars. Burns are what happen initially. When I eventually first saw myself in the mirror, which took some time to get to that point, I didn't look too bad. I was burnt. I had a red face. I was scabby. You know, they'd shaved off all my hair. But scarring hadn't taken on, you know, and it's the scarring which causes the disfigurement, and that can take weeks, months, or years. The biggest issue you have with scarring is tightness, or in more extreme circumstances, contraction. And the scars on my face contorted so much that it had pulled my eyelids down and my top eyelids up. And over time, my mouth's been pulled out of shape, my nose has been pulled up, and everything's been disfigured from the scarring, not from the burn, so to speak. But I lost my eyelids three times, where they had pulled down away from my eyes, away from my eyeballs, you know, your eyelids serve a purpose. They clear the tear film, they protect your eyes. I didn't have that. I had no way of closing my eyes. I had no way of escaping the dark. I had no way of escaping the light. You know, you can be in the darkest room and it still not be dark enough. So yeah, not having eyelids is
it's something
torturous.
It's just the assumption, the arrogance of health. You know, you assume everything, don't you?
Yeah, you really do.
And tell me about Theo then, your son. We'll come back to the case in a minute, but just, you know, his dad has now been transformed physically. He's still the same dad who loves him and is loved back inside. But from the outside, a very different person is coming home. Do you recall that time and the difficulty of the almost having to reintroduce yourself?
Without a doubt. Until that day came, until meeting Theo, that was the biggest challenge. Not anything else. It was how would Theo perceive me? Would he recognise me? Would he be scared of me? Would he think I look like a monster? Mm. You know, you spend a lot of time lying around in a hospital bed thinking, you know, and you create these... The more you think about something as negative as that, the bigger a problem it comes. The more you think it becomes a monster, the more you think about the monster, the bigger the monster becomes.
Yeah. You catastrophize, don't you?
Yeah, and that's, you know, it was my biggest fear. It was, you know, I guess a lot of people would be the same in that position, but for me, I was so focused on it, it got bigger and bigger and more problematic. Me and my wife made a decision very early on that he wasn't to come near the hospital. It wasn't a place for him. He didn't need to see what was going on. There was far too much, you know, on top of my injuries, far too much commotion, far too much the police always around. All these negative things he didn't need. He was with family members. He had food, water, toys and love. And that's all he needed to get him through the time. Yes, he should have been with his parents, but that couldn't happen at the time. My wife saw him regularly, but I obviously did not. When I was out of hospital, several months after the attack, we couldn't be in our house. There was the investigation still going on. We were residing in a secret location, so to speak. And my wife went and got my son, and she brought him down to see me. My family, who I was with at the time, stayed in the house, and I went outside, them respecting what I needed to do on my own. My wife got him out of the car, and he took one look at me and just clung onto my wife and buried his head into her neck, and my heart sank. My whole everything which I had, you know, built up in my head, the monster that I've been battling with for so long, became reality, and it was the toughest emotion I've ever had to deal with.
Yeah.
But then when I started talking, just made conversation, trying everything I could. He knew it was me straight away.
Yeah.
And he stuck his arms out and gave me a gigantic hug. He hugged me for almost an hour that day. And he's never hugged anybody. He's not a huggy baby. he just isn't.
That is the greatest
feeling in the world. A rollercoaster of emotions. I've never felt anything like it.
It's incredible how a child can sniff out the authentic and the beautiful, the beauty within.
He never batted an eyelid after that.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. He now, being older, being six, he knows everything. We've ensured with professional advice, you know, that he knew what happened and the reasons why. And now he gets a bit uneasy if he goes to the park and people are staring. Like,
sure.
He does care more now. But for years, it didn't bother him. He didn't even notice.
And Andreas, let's return to the case, because, as you say, everything was taken from you because the police were convinced that you had something to do with the case. And that all changed, obviously, when the detectives called you and said, we need to come and talk to you because there have been developments in the case, and this must have been a day to savour too.
So we had several of these meetings where senior officers from Devon and Cornwall Major Crimes would call in and go, we need a meeting. And you go, yeah, we could have something. And these meetings were dead ends, so to speak, on so many times. So it got to the point where I had accepted, not knowing, was a most probable outcome of the situation, and if that's how I've got to deal with things and move on, then fine, I will accept that and move on. And I was in this position of acceptance, really. My family weren't. God, they were almost definitely not. But I was. I had to be to move on. I wasn't going to be held back. I couldn't do it. So, yeah, they called another one of these emergency meetings, expecting it to be another non-meeting, so to speak. And they sat down and go, we know why, and we have the evidence to prove it. Which that was another insane emotion. I didn't know how to digest it. I just remember screaming at the top of my voice. Like, it was a strange, strange day. You know, I was happy, but God, I was angry at the same time. I did, you know, just an emotional volcano. Didn't know what to do.
What door had David Phillips, the attacker, meant to knock on?
So David Phillips, he drove 300 miles to Truro from Hastings, and he believed he was taking revenge on someone who had sexually assaulted someone he cared for. He was supposed to target someone who once lived on the same road as me. He turned up at the wrong house. Oh. But even if he turned up at the right house, he would have still got the wrong guy, because the guy who was his intended target had moved on.
Good Lord. And he pled guilty, sentenced to life, minimum of jail for 8 years. And you passed him by at one point, and he made a gesture. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, he pled guilty, although we weren't overly excited by the guilty plea, if I'm honest. We wanted to go to court, knowing that if we went to court, a lot of the information about the attack, about him, who he was, would be made general public, general knowledge, and it was not, because he pleaded. But yes, that day, after he had pleaded, we walked back into the courtroom, and it's the first time where I had actually seen him face to face. And you walk past the glass cubicle that they keep him in, and I stopped and looked at him, and he signalled to his heart, and I just shook my head and walked on. It was irrelevant. There's nothing he could say to me that could change any of this. There just isn't. You know, his barrister did offer to write a letter to me at one point explaining himself, but I can't see me being any better off for it.
And where is he today?
He is currently residing in Her Majesty's prison service somewhere. He was originally sentenced to life with a minimum term of 8 years. After that sentencing, so that was sentenced at Truro Crown Court, we appealed to the Attorney General, and on the longevity of the sentence, 8 years didn't seem right. He should be in jail for longer. That's was our general view. And I believe there's close to 70 appeals of the same nature made to the Attorney General. Someone from the AG's office phoned me up and said, look, the judge acted fairly. He was in line with other case law. Your appeal isn't to be granted. Unbeknown to us at the time, David Phillips had appealed the life aspect of his sentence. And frustratingly, his appeal was granted. So at that point, you kind of... You'd already kind of, well, this is over. And then all of a sudden you're going through appeal process and it's not over and you've been dragged out even longer. So I made a point of going up to the appellant court, High Courts London, with the senior police officers from Devon and Cornwall Police. I wanted the judges to see me. I wanted them to see the injuries. I wanted them to see firsthand the damage he had caused. We were the only people sat in a room that day. And I've since learned it's very rare for a victim to go and sit on an appeal case, but I wanted to be there. And that day, three of the highest ranking judges in this land, deemed him not to be a danger to society, deemed him not to be a dangerous man, and lifted life from his sentence, lightening his sentence to 16 years, of which he'll only serve 8 inside, which means he'll be out in 2022. And there's no doubt I'll still be having surgery for years to come, and I'm potentially facing a future of blindness if my eyes deteriorate further.
How do you feel about that?
I feel the system's broken. I feel that a lot of people expect me to be angry towards my attacker. He did what he did. Like, he, you know, there's nothing changing that. But the judges had the choice, you know, and the fact that they deem him not to be a dangerous man, and they deem him to be okay to be walking the streets when he took actions into his own hands in the way he did and made such a mistake of it, it doesn't make sense to me. You know, and that's the bit that frustrates me more so than anything else. The system's not working right.
What's the biggest change that's occurred to you, apart from the physical, the obvious physical changes? What has all of this experience done to you in your heart and soul, Andreas, as a person, as a dad, as a husband, as a man?
Oh, I'm a different person.
Are
if
you?
I'm honest, like, you know, I was once asked recently at a charity event if I could was giving a talk, and I had a Q&A afterwards, and they said I was asked if I could choose my life now or choose my life before the attack, which life would I choose? And I couldn't answer the question. It left foot in me and stumped me. Life is good now. It's very different. I'm a different man. I spend a lot more time with my family. I do a lot of charity work. I still run my own business. I don't work in the same capacity as I used to. But things are good. You know, I was reminded that the world is full of good people, I think. I had a huge amount of support from family and friends, but strangers from around the world. And it made me, I guess, look at the world slightly differently.
It's funny because when I knew I was going to be interviewing you, and then I saw in the paper the Joe Brand, the comedian, you know where I'm going to ask you now. She said the line about throwing milkshakes at Nigel Farage. She said, I'm thinking, why bother with a milkshake when you could get some battery acid? And I would have thought, oh, that's quite funny. And then I'm talking to you thinking, is that funny now, or do we, you know, do we have dark humour, or what do we say about that?
Reckless comments by Joe Brands. I think any person who has a large following, and let's face it, Joe Brand is a very successful presenting comedian, she should know better than to say things as reckless as that. I get comedy's comedy. I've laughed at lots of acid attack jokes.
Have you?
Yeah. One of my favourite comedians, Jimmy Carr. I remember being lying in a hospital bed listening to Jimmy Carr. I listened to a lot of Jimmy Carr when I was in hospital.
Yeah.
And he's got several. And I'm sat there going, oh, this is a bit awkward.
But why is Jimmy Carr's acid gag funny and hers isn't?
I think it was on the platform it was said.
Right.
Jimmy Carr's is a targeted audience. You know, he's speaking to a room full of people. Whereas I think when it's on national radio, national TV, I think it carries further weight.
Yes. You're an ambassador now for Face Forward. And you know, we've people in this country who will be familiar with that charity. And I presume, I suspect that it's good for you. It's something you enjoy doing, that you're not, you haven't decided to hold yourself up at home and not get involved.
Not at all. I've done a lot of work for charities since the attack. It's, you know, it's a way of paying it forward, and that is what Face Forward are about. You know, they help people. They specialise in facial reconstructive surgery for people of violent crime, and they're all about paying it forward. And they're a fascinating charity. Generally, are a fascinating charity. They've opened my eyes up to a different world. And you know, I've met people from scenarios from all around the world that they've helped, and each time I'm just jaw droppingly shocking the lengths they go to help these people around the world. Like, Face Forward have helped me with my surgery. I'm actually flying out there tomorrow morning for my next round of surgeries, and it's the golden ticket scenario for me. I firmly believe there isn't a better surgical path forward for me in my recovery. Even if I had a bottomless pit of money, I believe this is the best thing for my recovery. And it's great to be involved and to be an ambassador for such an amazing charity.
It's good to hear, Andreas. It's really good to hear you being so positive. Your story is extraordinary, and I can only wish you and your family all the very best into the future, and maybe we'll cross paths sometime. But I can't wish you enough good luck, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Andreas Christophorus joining us this morning with that story. The text number 51551.